The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Incremental. You've paused advertising and performance didn't change even though you're using an attribution provider? That's called cannibalization, and it's what happens when you don't measure value. True attribution should focus on value. True attribution measures incrementality, always on. Incremental is the only platform that measures incrementality without requiring any geolift experiments or A-B tests. Used by some of the most sophisticated companies in the world across iOS, Android, TV, CTV, influencers, and even billboards. Join the future of marketing measurement today with Incremental. To learn more, Google Incremental, the future of measurement, or use the link in this episode's description.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eric Sufert. I'm here today with Mikawai Barchenowicz, who is returning to the podcast for, I believe, the fourth time. Mikawai is an expert on EU law and EU privacy law, and I've invited him onto the podcast today to discuss the EDPB's recent opinion on the use of the pay or okay model. Mikawai, how are you?
I'm great, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Before we dive into the discussion, for those of the listeners who haven't heard you on the podcast before, please introduce yourself.
I'm a law professor in England at the University of Surrey. I'm also affiliated with a US-based think tank, the International Center for Law and Economics. And I've been thinking about EU tech regulation for a good while now. So,
I guess I will kick off this episode by invoking the Chinese aphorism, may you live in interesting times, as we certainly do. Isn't that correct?
Yes. These are certainly very interesting times for privacy lawyers. I've been joking with some other privacy experts on LinkedIn that EU law is really a make-work scheme for lawyers.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that way. So we are here today to talk about the EDPB's recent opinion, which they published yesterday as we record this on April 18th. So it was published April 17th, about the use of the pay or okay model for large online platforms. I think it's fair to scope that opinion to Meta specifically. I mean, that's essentially what this is in response to. It was Meta implementing the pay or okay model. We had a podcast dedicated to that. I want to say earlier this year, maybe it was the end of last year. So Meta implemented the pay or okay model in October of last year, was sort of immediately seized upon by the kind of activist set. And the EDPB was asked to provide an opinion about it. And here we are. So kind of as preface, as a way to kick off the conversation, can you give a high level overview of the opinion published by the EDPB yesterday?
Sure. So this opinion was requested by the Norwegian, Dutch, and one of the German data protection authorities. And they requested an opinion from the EDPB, the European Data Protection Board, which is kind of like a parliament or a corporate body for European data protection authorities. And so this is not a decision in a specific investigation, and this is not technically a decision in Meta's case. And my hot take about this is that reading it is like watching the EDPB try to bend over backwards to target big tech and Meta especially without harming German newspapers, while being forced by the EU Court of Justice to swallow the bitter pill that pay or consent is lawful, because that's one of the headline news, even though they kind of try to bury it, but they have to admit they can't contradict the Court of Justice. So pay or consent is lawful in principle. But they bury this conclusion in something that almost looks like a rant or a manifesto, but at the same time is extremely vague and conditional. So it looks like a result of an unhappy compromise between those DPAs who will try to interpret it to prohibit pay or consent everywhere they see it, and those DPAs who think that pay or okay is mostly fine. So the real fight will happen through those DPA's actions, and this EDPB opinion tells us what types of arguments will most likely be used, but very little about how any DPA would apply those arguments to the case of, well, most likely the first target will be Meta.
So a lot to unpack there, but I think maybe just to level set, the opinion does state that in most cases the implementation of Pay or OK by large online platforms is unlawful under the GDPR. Is that
correct?
My interpret. Okay. So a couple of things I want to address just before we move on to the kind of bigger topic. So you said, okay, you think that this might have been the result, and you know, reading the opinion, it feels like very, first of all, very irresolute.
Yes.
It feels very equivocal in a lot of ways, right? They make the point, which is it is unlikely that large online platforms are implementing Pay or OK in a way that's valid under the GDPR. Yes. So that's kind of the takeaway. That's the headline. But many of the points, many of the sort of like much of the support for that feels equivocal. But you made a point that I found really interesting, which is that you believe that there probably was a lack of unanimity in across the DPAs that comprise the EDPB. How far does that weigh on one side or the other? Do you feel like it was maybe one or two dissenters and the vast majority kind of believe one way? Or do you feel like maybe it was split down the middle? How much sort of discord do you think there is across the EDPB on this topic?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. So I don't have any inside intel on what happened. But looking at how vague and conditional the text is makes me guess that actually the split is not such that there is like two or three out of 20, more than 20 authorities that are not agreeing with the program of just declaring Pay or OK illegal, but actually that it's a higher number. And another reason to think that a higher number, even including some of the privacy authorities, which usually are perceived as the hawks, as those more radical authorities in implementing privacy law. Because if you look at the history, the recent history of national guidance on Pay or OK, several authorities green-lighted it in principle, right? So we have the three who have a strong view who requested this opinion. So Norway, Netherlands, and one of the German ones. But even the conference of German authorities was not among them. And the conference of German authorities, for example, is one of those who issued guidelines that kind of okay it in principle. So I think that it may be closer to the middle.
I see. It was the Hamburg DPA, right? So
yes.
As you explained, I think in the first podcast we did, there are more DPAs than there are EU countries, and that's because some countries have multiple DPAs.
And the Germans have one vote, but they have many representatives, but they vote as one.
Okay, so we think there's probably not total alignment across the DPAs, but that's a phenomenon that I think we can see elsewhere, right? Because the EDPB issued guidance on usage of certain attribution methodologies that are essentially covered under the e-privacy directive.
Yes.
And last year in November, if I remember correctly, and there was dissent across the DPAs around whether the EDPB had any sort of authority to provide guidance around the enforcement of the e-privacy directive, because that is...
Yes, because it's not the GDPR. It's a totally different law.
Well, and also it's transposed into national law, right? Within all the EU countries, right? And so the EDPB, for those unfamiliar, it emerged, it was created to enforce the GDPR. So there's really no natural, obvious agency that it has over the e-privacy directive. And so the EDPB came out with this sort of guidance around how some of these attribution methodologies should be interpreted within the context of the e-privacy directive. And the Finnish DPA actually wrote sort of a dissenting opinion. They said, look, A, there was sort of like some belief that, you know, the EDPB just had no authority there. But B, the Finnish DPA came back and they sort of like published this opinion and said, look, what you're saying is not true, that these aren't really violations, that they're not actually storing things on the user's terminal, that when you click on a URL, that's not storing anything in the user's terminal. So the e-privacy directive isn't even really applicable. And the head of the EDPB is Finnish. Right. So I think, I don't know if that's just like an irrelevant detail there, but like, it feels like there has been some discord potentially bubbling to the surface for a while, or at least for a few months.
Well, it's partly also because those authorities that enforce the e-privacy directive are not necessarily the same authorities which enforce the GDPR on a national level. So there are authorities, national authorities, which are in charge of national e-privacy rules, but they are not part of the EDPB. That's one of the reasons, by the way, why for the argument that the EDPB acted without authority issuing those guidelines, because they don't even represent all the national authorities who enforce this law.
Okay, so big picture takeaway from the opinion is that EDPB believes that these large online platforms most likely are not implementing PayRoK in a way that's lawful under the GDPR. How does the EDPB present the use of PayRoK as not providing a valid consent mechanism, right? Because that's essentially what their argument boils down to. It's that they're not providing a valid consent mechanism when as implemented currently. How are they presenting that? What's that argument that they're making?
So under the GDPR, if you can't use any of the other legal bases like contractual necessity, legitimate interest, and some others, well, you may have to rely on user consent for processing their personal data. And the GDPR further specifies that consent has to be freely given, right? It has to be genuine, it has to be free. And this whole debate is about how to understand this requirement. What does it mean for consent to be freely given? And what the EDPB is trying to say in this opinion is that because of some features of the relationship between large online platforms and their users, it's at least unlikely in most cases that users can give consent. So it's not about whether even users consider this sort of subjectively, but more also about the objective situation. So the arguments they use are arguments we know mostly from competition law or from antitrust economics. So arguments like buzzwords like network effects, lock-in. And if you read those paragraphs about that, it almost looks like like advertising for this unnamed large online platform, which is the sort of real target here, right? It's almost someone commented on LinkedIn that you could give a funny headline to this opinion. So EDPB says Facebook is great for user emotional or psychological well-being, right? Because if you take it away, then suddenly it's a massive detriment to users. But that's kind of the argument they make, that because it has grown so large and because it's so important in user lives, that if you take it away, then it's you don't really have a practical alternative, right? So this imbalance of power is one of the main arguments why to take it away is a detriment. And if it's a detriment, that also goes back to the GDPR, because the GDPR says in one of the recitals that data subjects should be able to withdraw their consent without refuse or withdraw their consent without detriment. So that's the question, right? And then this also goes to pricing, but I think that this imbalance of power, another argument about the scale of processing and how much data they have, that's the core of the argument here.
Right. Yeah, I agree that it's an interesting argument to make because it effectively is cheerleading for the role that Meta's products play in consumers' lives, right? And underscores its importance to its users, right? So I actually kind of seized upon this one paragraph on X last night while I was writing a piece that I published today about this. But this is what the EDPB writes in their opinion. Data subjects may suffer detriment if it becomes impossible for them to use a service that is part of their daily lives and has a prominent role. This could be the case, for instance, of a platform that is commonly and systematically used to disseminate information that may not be readily available from other sources, or of a platform whose use is necessary to have access to certain services relevant for the individual's daily life. This may be information or exchanges which the users are reliant upon in their daily lives, which makes it harder for them not to participate on the platform. These types of situations may range from important information during public emergencies to parents receiving information regarding social activities for the children. Additionally, the platform may be a key forum for public debate on political, social, cultural, and economic issues. Well, isn't it great if there's a service that provides all of that, right? And so what the EDPB is essentially saying is that you have to provide a poorly monetized version of this product, right? You can't charge for it, or you can't only charge for it or provide a personally, behaviorally advertised version of it. You have to also provide a free version that is monetized poorly. That's essentially what they're saying. They're essentially calling these kind of products utilities, right? And those utilities have to be made not only available in a free version, right? But also they must be poorly monetized. Otherwise, you are creating harm in the user's life. Is that like a valid interpretation of what they said in that paragraph?
I mean, yes. So it's interesting that the EDPB is very clearly pushing one solution to this whole problem. So they say the choice that users are presented with should not be binary. It shouldn't be consent to behavioral advertising or pay for an option without consenting. There should also be what they call free alternative without behavioral advertising. We started using an acronym, but I'm not sure even how to try to pronounce this acronym, FAUBA. Maybe let's not do it, but you will probably see this acronym all over LinkedIn and Twitter soon. Because one problem is that we don't really understand what they mean by it. In paragraph 75, they describe it this way. This alternative must entail no processing for behavioral advertising purposes and may, for example, be a version of the service with a different form of advertising involving the processing of less or no personal data, for example, contextual or general advertising, or advertising based on topics, the data subject selected from a list of topics of interest, right? So it almost looks like they say that there need to be three options. So one is consent with behavioral, then paid with no behavioral, and then free with some other kind of monetization, which is also an interesting question of like, how could that be viable, right? Why would then anyone pay for the paid option? Although you probably can load with a paid option with some bonuses, that's what I say, although the EDPB wants to say that actually, no, you can't try to make the paid option too nice, which I think has no justification, but we can come back to that in a second. But this is the problem, right? They say there should be three options at least.
Well, the problem there is there's any number of models that you could use to monetize a product, right? Maybe it's contextual advertising, maybe it's metered usage, right? I mean, this is the point I make I wrote an article about, because the European Commission is also investigating the use of the pay or okay model by Meta as part of the DMA enforcement, right? And they say, well, you know, they use some real mental gymnastics to determine that it's some sort of competitive violation, so competition violation. But, you know, the point I make is like, well, you can't say, okay, well, you have to, in order to fully facilitate user choice, these are the three commercial monetization options available to you. Well, no, there's innumerable commercial options. So does a product have to offer all of them? Because again, it's not just paid upfront, or it's not just subscription, contextual, or behavioral. It could be just an upfront pay gate. You've got to pay $200 to access this, and that's lifetime access, right? Or it could be metered usage. You pay by the minute, right? So is it incumbent upon a product operator to offer every single possible monetization mechanic, right? I mean, it's not just those three. Those are three arbitrary ones that the EDPB and I guess the EC have determined that all must be offered. But what about all the others? But I think the other issue here is this idea that these are equivalent. Right, there is no equivalence between contextual advertising and behavioral advertising. Just because they have the name or the word advertising in the name doesn't mean they're somehow equivalent, or really even of the same kind of, you know, conceptual type. Like, they're just very different approaches to serving ads. And so I don't even understand why that contextual is seen as like a foil or like a counterweight to behavioral. They're very different approaches to monetizing a product.
Well, to be fair to them, they don't say it has to be contextual. They say that it has to be without behavioral advertising.
Right, sure.
So the defenders of this opinion, they will be quick to point out that it doesn't say what kind of monetization it should be. What it needs to be is free and equivalent in features. Not without, you know, degraded features compared to this option that involves behavioral advertising. That's what's required.
Okay, yeah, that's true. That's a good point, right? But again, then I just go back to my point. Well, then do they have to offer every single possible option for monetizing the product, right? Because why just pick those three? Those are totally, there's a wide array. There's a sort of vast menu of tactics, mechanics that could be used to monetize a product. Is every single product operator obligated to offer all of them? Yeah. Why stop at these three? Okay. But let's talk about large online platforms, right? So, you know, I wrote this piece last night, published it today. And, you know, in order to even really approach this topic, the EDPB had to do something very specific, which was carve out a distinction to engineer a distinction between the companies, the types of products that have been using PayerOkay for years after having been scrutinized by, you know, the sort of privacy apparatus in the EU for compliance with the GDPR, They had to carve out a distinction between those companies who've been using Payroll for a long time and the companies that most recently introduced it. And so talk to me about that. So again, like the opinion is scoped to large online platforms. How does the EDPB define those?
So it's scoped to large online platforms because that's what the three authorities who want, you know, PayRK prohibited. That's how that was their strategic choice, right? So the request was scoped this way, and the EDPB then agreed to rule within that request. And but the justification for it is exactly what you said. They are trying quite clearly to carve a double standard here. And but it's interesting because EU law knows the term online platform. It uses it in other pieces of legislation than GDPR, but the but EU privacy law does not have such term. So within the context of privacy law, this is totally made up. It's just taken from nowhere. And even if you read the way this opinion refers to it, it doesn't say that, we say that this should be read as it is read in the, actually in the Digital Services Act, and refers to kind of Web 2 hosting services where users provide content. But no, they say that it may involve those services, but may also not involve some other services, right? So it only gives kind of a list, and it's beautiful, and it's very indicative of this opinion. Like if in paragraph 24, how they define it, or they say they define the process of defining. So they say that they highlight certain elements to be assessed on a case-by-case basis to determine whether a controller is to be considered as a large online platform, taking into account that certain elements may be more relevant for certain controllers than others. This list is not exhaustive, nor a list of cumulative requirements. It just provides a list of indication. I read it in full because it's really a great example of the way the whole opinion reads. So yes, so it's really, they don't commit to anything. It's whatever you want to make it. And they give this list of several factors. So the factors are large amount of users, market position, and whether they conduct large-scale processing. But I think it's a common view that even though they probably tried to define it in a way that would be mostly applicable to Facebook, Instagram, there is no principled reason why this wouldn't apply, for example, to a large newspaper publisher who has many users in Germany and has a large market position in Germany, right? That's a market. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's, so there's kind of two big holes in that. So first of all, they talk about this large scale processing, which they admit isn't defined by the GDPR, but they say, well, there was guidance given by the Article 29 Working Party, right? Which was kind of the predecessor to the EDPB, right? So this isn't really well defined.
No.
But to your point, this is a point that you've made. Who engages in more large scale processing? Yeah. A newspaper that monetizes through the open programmatic web? Or a company that manages all of this data within its own data environment that isn't accessible by any other party, right? So if you're talking about a company that engaging in large-scale data processing, well, okay, by sheer volume of data, it's probably Meta outranks a German newspaper. But if you think about by the number of parties, if you define that by the number of parties that have access to that data, it's not.
Yeah, usually here, I'm not sure they say large and intrusive, but in many other instances, those words are used together, right? So it's large scale processing and it is intrusive. So the point I always make is that if you try to compare walled gardens versus the open ecosystem, well, this intrusiveness in the open ecosystem, even if the scale in the amount of data may be comparable, there is an argument to be made that at least some parts of the open ecosystem are more intrusive than what happens within the walled gardens.
Right. It's you know, there'll be like an article about this every so often, and the irony of it, or call it the hypocrisy of it, is whatever newspaper publishing this sort of like breathless, you know, scare article about like the number of companies that are involved in like serving a web page will have all of these sort of trackers embedded in that in their own website, right? But like, you know, you might load a web page from a major news publisher, and there'll be 1,500 parties that are invoked in that process. Right. I mean, so if you talk about large scale data processing, is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about just the ownership of this data by a platform? Now, obviously, you know, I'm not trying to sort of downplay or minimize the amount of data that a Meta or a Google process, they process vast amounts of data. I mean, that's not up for debate, but they don't make it available to other parties. they receive it from advertisers, but they don't make it available to other parties, right? And so you need to sort of be a little bit, I think in order for that to be credible, I think you need to sharpen it a little bit. The other thing is large online platforms are platforms that attract a large amount of data subjects as their users. Okay, well, I guess that's tautologically true. Sure. How large? That seems quite vague. Position in the market. Okay, which market, right? Because yeah. Der Spiegel has a pretty, you know, sort of pronounced position in the German newspaper market, right?
Exactly.
Large scale processing. Okay, well, what are you talking about here? Are you talking about the participation by parties, or are you talking about just the sheer volume of data? And then the last was whether the company is identified as a very large online platform by the DSA or a gatekeeper by the DMA. Okay, well, now we've really gotten to where you wanted to go. You've ring-fenced this to ByteDance plus the largest American tech companies. Okay, that's really what you wanted to say, wasn't it? All of the rest of this was kind of window dressing. It was kind of a way to not seem so brazen. And to your point, I mean, they don't weight these. They don't say that this is an exhaustive list. They just say, well, these are kind of the considerations that we would use in considering what a large online platform is.
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to July of last year, the CJEU issued this ruling in the German cartel office case. I don't know how to pronounce the word in German, but you know, July 4th, which is I'll forever remember that day just because it's an important day in the US. July 4th, they issued this ruling. They had a lot of commentary about behavioral advertising generally and the use of consent. But talk to me about that commentary, because that commentary plays a large role in this opinion.
So what the EDPB does not do is they are trying to avoid an impression that they are contradicting the Court of Justice. So the strategy they adopted is to try to explain how they think what the court said should be interpreted. And so far, I haven't noticed any obvious contradictions between what they say. And that's also largely because of how vague and conditional anything the EDPB says is in this opinion. So what they try to explain is the sentence from the Court of Justice, where the Court of Justice says that there may be an option when you want to ask for consent for this kind of processing for behavioral advertising. You may need to provide an equivalent alternative if necessary for an appropriate fee. And by the way, that's what the English version says, but not what some other language version say. What those other language versions don't necessarily include is the word necessity. And that's something that I actually agree with the EDPB opinion on, because they propose an interpretation of this necessity for an appropriate fee that really just kind of waters necessity down and really makes it all about appropriateness. And I think the reason why they do it goes to the question of contractual necessity, because there is a point I've been making since that July judgment that when the court said, if necessary for an appropriate fee, it sounded like, wait, if it's necessary to charge a fee, how is that not necessary for the contract between a user and the business, right? So that would make it contractual necessity. And in that case, it's like, shouldn't we be even talking about consent? So I think that the piece of the authors, they really don't even want to talk about the possibility of this being contractual necessity. So, and they also didn't want to say that the Court of Justice said something nonsensical. So they would rather say, okay, let's not talk about necessity. But what this means is that it kind of, this interpretation makes it slightly easier for businesses to claim that they are complying with this appropriate fee requirement, because now they don't have to say that it's kind of, they don't have to, I don't know, provide accounting to show that, we could not survive without this, you know, business model, right? Because there is no such strong necessity requirement. So it's just appropriateness, and this appropriateness here is just so vague that really there is nothing that we can learn from it. It's just appropriate. And then they say some things about equivalent alternatives. And I think we mentioned that already. So the idea is that this free consent option with behavioral advertising shouldn't be more attractive in terms of functions, which I guess makes sense. But they also say another thing, which I think is a bit strange. They said it's problematic if alternatives without behavioral advertising are better than the option with behavioral advertising. And here, so think about Facebook and Instagram offering what they call subscription with no ads. So it's not a subscription with no personalized ads, but it's no ads whatsoever. So in a sense, you could say that it's actually a more attractive thing than, you know, they could have offered, right? But I just don't see where is the justification for what they say here, because isn't the whole point that if you make an alternative to consent as attractive as possible, then you reduce any pressure to consent, right? So actually it should be like, they should be cheerleading for this paid option to be, to have as many bells and whistles right. as possible, because that would make it more attractive and thus reduce that pressure. So yeah, I don't understand that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So maybe just kind of take a step back for the people that don't follow this as closely as you do. So first of all, what's the CJEU? Just to provide some context to people. So the CJEU is?
The Court of Justice of the European Union. So our Supreme Court.
Right. Okay. So and what did they say in the July 4th ruling? So the ruling wasn't really related to personalized advertising. It was related to something. It was really a competition issue, but they had some commentary about personalized advertising that the EDPB took guidance from. What did they say in that commentary?
And another thing that we should remember, it's a hill I will die on. It was not about first party data. It was about combining third party data
right.
across services. So yes, very limited judgment. But in one paragraph, the court just, when talking about consent to personalized advertising, and also within the context of also talking about Facebook potentially being in a dominant position in sort of competition law terms, so which could potentially, according to the court, affect the analysis whether users can freely give consent vis-a-vis Facebook and Instagram. So in this context, the court said that actually there may be a solution that if you have this option, you ask users to consent for behavior advertising, you may also offer them, it may be fine if you offer them an alternative, which is equivalent, and it may be also fine to charge an appropriate fee for it.
Right. Okay. So what the EDPB was forced to do was to navigate that line in the sand that the CJEU constructed, which is that, look, this could be legitimate. You can't just dismiss this out of hand. It's just that they threw out this appropriate fee modifier, which again is vague, right? But that was originally the vector of attack, right? That's what NOIP came back with. It's like, well, this is an inappropriate fee because, you know, if every consumer tech product did this, a family of four would be paying 35,000 euros a month or a year or something. And so I wrote a piece about this and you know, I said, okay, well, maybe there's a standard we should apply here. And I proposed that an appropriate fee is just whatever achieves ARPU parity, right? ARPU being average revenue per user. And if you consider that opting into or subscribing to a paid product is a signal of disposable income, those are probably the most valuable users, right? And those are the ones that advertisers actually want to reach. And the ones left are the ones potentially without disposable income using the personalized advertising product, because the ones that are so averse to personalized advertising probably are going to subscribe if they have the money. And if they don't, they're probably just not going to use the product anymore. They probably weren't using it in the first place, right? They're so offended by it. And so whatever's left is people that actually really enjoy the product. They have no problem with personalized advertising and they don't have disposable income. Or they do have a problem with personalized advertising, but they enjoy the product so much that they aren't going to abandon it, right? And in any case, those are probably not the most valuable users. And so the ARPU on the free tier is going to drop, right? Because you shifted all of the high value users into the paid version. And so actually, that's the bar to clear. And so that's the price you have to charge. It's not the ARPU pre-breakup. It's not the ARPU pre-fracturing. It's the ARPU post-fracturing. It's the ARPU when all the high-value users move to the subscription package. It's that ARPU. That's the ARPU you have to clear in order to make this ARPU neutral. And so now I think the real question is, will the EDPB allow, given that idea of detriment, given that idea of equivalent, will they allow? Because everyone's first thought here was, okay, well, the free version without personalized ads, if you have to offer this as three versions now, free version with contextual, free version with behavioral, and then paid version with none, then the free version with contextual, which is probably what most people would opt into when they're making the choice, because why wouldn't they? It's difficult to make the case for why you should choose the behavioral version. So if the majority of people opt into now the version with just contextual, then Meta will probably just stuff that full of ads. They will probably just ramp the ad load to 11 in order to try to make up for some of the ARPU, some of the lost ARPU. Well, could the EDPB say, well, no, that's not an equivalent product. You've just degraded the product. Yeah. And that's not compliant.
Well, they could try to say that.
Look, I mean, if this is being undertaken in good faith, I don't know why they would care. But if it's not, then yeah, they're going to say, wait a second, you just made the product worse. And therefore, you're not offering a valid choice.
I mean, from their perspective, this complaining about too many ads may also make sense, because then they would say, actually, if you have fewer ads and the ads are nicer in the personalized free version, then that actually sort of nudges users to choose the version that's worse for them. Of course, worse not according to the users, but worse according to us, the privacy activists, right? And the authorities.
Yeah, sure. But is that then sort of like an acknowledgement that these authorities may have been just co-opted by the activist class? Because it seems like they're just sort of being dragged along.
I mean, it's an argument I've been making for a while. I think it's not true of all data protection authorities in Europe, but I think that it's the sort of data protection, privacy communities is a bit of a silo, and then people who end up working in those authorities, I think it's easy to be captured by your mission, especially if your mission is so narrowly construed and you're given so much power, right? So it looks like you're given power to restructure markets, but there is only one thing to bear in mind: privacy, right? So one of the arguments I'm making, thinking about reform of this system, is that at least those authorities, if they are given so much power, should also be given a responsibility to look at all the consequences of their actions, right? Not just privacy. Mm-hmm. But yes, but if you give people a lot of power, a closed community, and one mission, it kind of makes sense that they would become believers in that mission.
Yeah, well, that's the luxury of being an activist, right? You are allowed to have a singular mission. You're allowed to have a singular outcome that you pursue, and you don't have to consider anything else in the pursuit of that, right? I mean, it's like if I was an activist about traffic deaths, I'd say, well, speed limit 10 miles an hour.
Yeah.
That's it. That'll do it. If you can't go faster than 10 miles an hour, there's probably not going to be any traffic deaths, right? Obviously, that's going to create a whole lot of other knock-on effects and problems. But if that's the thing that I'm singularly concerned with, that will do it. You will achieve that. And it's not to say that privacy is not something that should be accommodated for. It's not to say that privacy is not important, right? But it's just any sort of like a reasonable person needs to take more things into account when they try to construct policy that supports user privacy. That's a great segue into the next question, which is, what do you think the unforeseen consequences of this are? Because my sense is, given the vague definition of large online platforms, it's going to apply to a lot more than just Meta, right? And this is probably going to apply to a lot of companies that were already sort of using PayerOK. They just didn't make a big production out of it, right? I mean, Meta's transition to PayerOK was kind of a spectacle, right?
Yes.
But YouTube has essentially been using this for years and years, right? Now, are they constrained by this? What about Spotify? Spotify has a free tier with ads and a paid tier. Are they constrained by this? Like, what do you think the unforeseen consequences are going to be?
Well, I don't think there is any limiting principle here that is clear. But of course, applying this to YouTube and Spotify, that's probably something that's a sacrifice that is definitely ready for. But what's maybe more problematic for them in political terms is if this is also applicable to German newspapers again. So that could be a problem. And I also don't see a limiting principle if you have a newspaper with many readers, many users, given the country market and or linguistic area, and then a large market position in that market. How are they not one of those large platforms here? So yes, so I think the breadth of applicability could be a surprise. Those issues of what, you know, like we talked about pricing, if you look at what they say about pricing, is it's really quite radical, because they say that the fee should not be such to effectively inhibit data subjects from making a free choice, for example, by nudging the data subjects toward consenting. I mean, nudging seems such a low bar. Like, what if anything other above zero nudges me to consent?
Right.
Which is actually, I would suggest,
the case. Yeah.
Exactly the case, yeah. Right? So does that mean that any price was prohibited for everyone, including all the businesses we mentioned? So yes, so I think that if you take this document seriously, then of course it could have all those consequences. But I would say that it's sort of, pessimistically or not, it's probably not going to be applied equally to everyone.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can tell you that having worked in the freemium space for essentially my whole career, and you know, having taken like an intellectual interest in the freemium model and wrote a book about it called Freemium Economics, that just there's a psychological impact of a price point.
Yeah.
Even having a price point of a single cent presents a psychological barrier to adoption, right? And it's going to reduce conversion rates, right? And so the second that, you know, you implement a price at all, it's going to push people in the direction of the free version, the free variant, right? And so, but also, isn't nudge sort of like an imprecise word?
Well, yes.
This whole thing just felt so poorly defined, or everything about this opinion just felt like it was vibe based. There's just not a lot of precision, not a lot of rigor in the way that this was written. And there's so many ways to misinterpret it or interpret it in multiple ways. I'm just worried that that opens the door. So first of all, I mean, we have to acknowledge that this isn't a legally binding decision in any way, right? This isn't an action that they're taking. This is an opinion. So I guess the question is, what happens next, right? Is this now like the DPAs are free to take this up? Or would Meta appeal this in some way? I mean, again, it's just an opinion. So what happens next?
Yeah, so I don't think this can be appealed because it's not an individual decision, but it will likely be scrutinized by courts indirectly. So what I'm guessing will happen now is that national DPAs will start making their own decisions on payer consent cases, following their own interpretations of what this opinion means or how to interpret the GDPR, taking this opinion into account. So definitely, I can imagine the Norwegian or other authorities, they will use this, and they will also use it in such a way to say, this is obviously what this means, right? So like I'm like almost certain that this is how this is going to be used. This will be presented as clear. So definitely determining, you know, how to apply it in various cases, exactly the way, obviously, as the author intends to apply it, right? So, and I guess that's the sort of cost of this compromise, that all authorities will be able to take it the way they want it. But the ones that will actually do something with it are probably those who actually want to curb payer consent as much as possible, right? So we can talk about which ones are likely to do it. There is an Irish investigation. I'm not going to be surprised if the Norwegians are trying to undermine the one-stop shop again. So yes, so that is probably coming up next.
So that kind of brings me back to my point about, you know, the EDPB maybe having been co-opted by, you know, sort of like an activist class. But I made the point in the last podcast we recorded that Norway doesn't have a seat at the table in the EDPB, by which I meant they don't have a
yes.
vote, because they don't, because they're not in the EU, right? Norway's not in the EU. It's not an EU country. And I said, they don't have a seat at the table. And someone got very agitated by that on LinkedIn and said, oh, you're spreading misinformation. What I meant was Norway doesn't have a vote. I think that's a colloquialism. Maybe it only exists in the US, but they don't have a seat at the table. They don't have a vote, right? But why do they get to drive this? Because ultimately they did. Right, they made the decision to ban Meta's behavioral advertising in Norway. Right, they got a temporary license to do that by the EDPB, and then they appealed to the EDPB and they said you should roll this out EU-wide, and they did. Why do they get to drive this? Norway's not in the EU. I mean, I guess this is just a function of the political agreement, but still, like Norway. So first of all, they were kind of at the vanguard of limiting ads personalization, period, with political advertising, you know, many years ago. But there seems to be a political force within Norway that is very hostile towards behavioral advertising. Why do they get to drive the decisions made by the EDPB in this way?
Well, to be fair, it's not just Norway. There is also the Netherlands and you have Hamburg here. So, but yes, Norway, that's because of there is this sort of EU plus called the EEA, the European Economic Area. There is mm-hmm. an EEA treaty, and this arrangement extends some parts of the EU in a sense to several countries which are not part of the EU. But so that's the legal reason, and that's why they can sort of benefit from some procedural aspects of the GDPR, including the urgency procedure. But yeah, so they will probably, I mean, I'm guessing they may want to use this urgency procedure again. So we could have a repeat of exactly the same scenario of what happened last year, that the Norwegians or the Dutch, they will say, oh, the Irish are too slow coming with their draft opinion. So let's, you know, this is urgent. this is new and so on. So we will try with temporary measures, temporary ban for our territory, and ask the DPB to step in. So, I mean, I think that's a realistic scenario. There is another scenario because, by the way, the one-stop shop is dead. If anyone wants to hear about that, we can talk about this. But actually, there is, in mid-February, the EDPB made another opinion where they basically declared one-stop shop inapplicable to American big tech companies. So yes, so it could be that even without using urgency as an argument, some authorities might rely on this new interpretation that actually they don't need to be bound by one-stop shop, and they can still, anyone can sort of now play the role of the lead authority. So yes, someone will probably do it. And if it's the Irish authority that first drafts a decision, then we can again have a repeat of what happened before. So the Irish authority may draft a, you know, a reasonable and proportionate decision which could accommodate Meta's subscription with no ads. And then they circulate it and several other authorities object. And then there is a vote. So the Irish authority in the end could be forced to adopt a different decision than what they wanted, right? So in a sense, irrespective of where it starts, the result will probably be dictated by the majority of the DPB.
So kind of unpack that. What happened in mid-February and why is the one-stop shop dead?
So again, the EDPB issues those opinions from time to time, and I think it was the French authority, the CNIL, who has been frustrated by this concept of one-stop shop, because we talked about this already, but the idea of one-stop shop was part of the general GDPR legislative deal, and it was meant to provide businesses which are operating cross borders across Europe, but head establishment in one European country, that they have one single interlocutor authority to talk to and to be regulated by under the GDPR. And because many of the big tech companies, American big tech companies, are established for this purpose in Ireland, the Irish Data Protection Commission became their lead authority. But that is something that at least several other national authorities have been unhappy with, the French one among them. So they tried other sort of non-GDPR routes, like e-privacy in some cases we also talked about in previous podcasts. But suddenly they came with an idea, why not just say that this is a fiction, that, for example, Facebook or some other American company is really established in Ireland. And the conclusion of that opinion sort of runs with it, and it says that this one-stop shop mechanism can only apply if there is evidence that one of the establishments in the union of the controller takes the decisions on the purposes and means for the relevant processing operations and has the power to have those decisions implemented. When the decisions on the purposes and means and the power are exercised outside of the union, there should be no main establishment and the one-stop shop mechanism should not apply. So if they can argue that all those decisions and the power to exercise them is taken in, you know, in Palo Alto or Mountain View, then there's no one-stop shop. So that's why I said that they declared it inapplicable to American companies. Obviously, this will be fact-based and there may be some litigation on it, but that could be the end of the one-stop shop.
Right. And so just kind of tying that together with the what happens next question, you've eliminated the sort of restriction that only the DPA in the country where the EU HQ is domiciled can sort of take this forward. And in doing that, it allows the most activist DPA to take it forward.
It's a free for all. Yeah.
Right. It's a free for all. Obviously, the most activist ones are the only ones interested in taking this forward. And so they're going with. Do they have to fight over who gets to, I mean, do they have to agree over who gets to take this forward?
That's a good question. So I'm not sure exactly which way they will do it. And there is one reason why I think they might actually prefer the urgency procedure, because the second thing is still untested, whereas the urgency procedure is already tested, right? We've seen it happen last year from what the Norwegians did, and it ended up with the DPP decision in October, right? So it feels like a safer way to go, whereas here they could try it in some member state, and then for example one of Meta or someone else could actually win against them in domestic administrative courts, saying that you're misinterpreting the GDPR and this EDPB opinion is just wrong, right? So they run the risk of losing in their own courts on a jurisdictional point, whereas with urgency they may be less at risk of that. So that's why I think the repeat of a scenario from last year is more likely.
Okay, so let me kind of extrapolate that. So what could happen is Norwegian DPA uses the urgency procedure, takes this to the EDPB. They said, look, based on your opinion, this payer okay model is illegal under the GDPR. Yeah. And then it essentially, we go through this process again. So then, you know, it's back to the drawing board. And then Meta has to get rid of that business model and introduce something else. And by the way, I mean, we talk about Meta a lot because that's essentially the catalyst for this. But I know that every other social media platform was looking to this decision to determine if they were going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, every social media platform would have done exactly the same thing because they're all constrained by the elimination of legitimate interest as a legal basis for data processing for behavioral advertising. They all are. It's not just Meta, right? And so they were all, so if this would have been allowed, this would have become essentially the de facto law of the land, and they all would have done it, right? And so they're all looking to see what happens and what their options are. So it's not just Meta is my point. Okay, Mikwai, this is fantastic. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. How can people engage with you? How can they find you on Twitter, on your Substack, on LinkedIn? Where should they go to see your content?
So yes, I have a Substack on how Elon affects tech, and I'm also on LinkedIn, a bit less on X these days, but probably the Substack is the best way. So it's my surname.substack, and my surname is quite tricky, but just read the show notes.
Yeah, you need to come up with a catchier brand.
I know, maybe, I know.
MB Privacy or something like that. Well, Mikwai, I will link to all of those outlets, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.